Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really exciting founder, you know, definitely a founder that is building a rocket ship. We're going to be talking all about the stuff that we like to hear. You know, that could be the sacrifice that founders make when they go at it, you know, as entrepreneurs. That could also be the way that you deal with raising money and the way that you engage with your investors, you know, perhaps venture capital firms. You know, it doesn't need to be the typical structure as you go from one life cycle to the next, or that goes in parallel with a financing cycle. But in the end, really looking at every opportunity, every company, you know, being its own story, its own life. And I think that we're going to be talking about that, you know, quite a bit. And then also being able to establish a culture that allows not only to survive, but to thrive, and being able to do that as a founder and CEO. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Amitai Ratson. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So originally born and raised in Israel, give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up over there?
Yeah, it's growing up and living here. Well, Israel is a unique place, as I'm sure our listeners are aware. I've had great childhood back in Jerusalem, back in the days. Classic kind of 90s childhood. I was born in 1976. Really was a great basketball fan, and I hope great player as well. I still play basketball. You know, the old of four brothers living in one of the suburbs of Jerusalem. You know, really kind of always aspiring for excellence when I was a kid. School was really, really important to me. You know, when I got like a 94 score out of 100, I missed like two more, so it kind of, you know, so it's closer to 100 than to 90. I was this perfectionist kind of kid. I wanted to kind of really be good at many, many things at the same time. From that Jerusalem childhood, I went on, you know, an army service like we all do here in Israel. Very proud of my service at the IDF. Then,
you know, obviously from childhood to now, I mean, you still play basketball, right? I mean, you are a competitive guy. And for people that are not able to see the video now, you know, there's like, I see trophies, you know, like behind you. I guess the question that I want to ask you, yeah, there you go. So the question that I want to ask you is, I mean, it kind of like reminds me of the documentary of The Last Dance with Michael Jordan, where it's not just about the sport, it's about leadership. What would you say that you've taken from all this time playing basketball and from being, you know, part of such a competitive sport too? What are the main things that you've taken with you that has formed the way that you think about leadership and entrepreneurship?
Yeah, so I think you mentioned Michael Jordan, which is, you know, people that can judge by my age could probably realize that you couldn't not adore Michael Jordan when I grew up. So he is my childhood icon. And the few things that I took from Michael, I would really refer to two things. And I think those kind of stayed, you know, I think part of me. One is that I think Michael, one of his famous statements is people asked him, so who do you compete against? Like, who is like the player you want to be like, or who is your idol? And Michael Jordan always said, I compete against myself yesterday. So I think this kind of, you know, resembles, you know, me in a way, in a different way, of course. But I was brought up not to kind of just adore anyone and just worship people. You know, it takes hard work to become something. So you, instead of just like blindly admiring someone, a better approach probably would be to try to work hard and beat this someone. So since I grew up as a competitive kid, one thing I took from, you know, the Jordan days is to always try to be a better version of myself. And my benchmark is myself yesterday. The second thing that, you know, that Michael said and I take from those days, at one point people asked Michael Jordan after he had like five championships and people asked him, a journalist, I mean, what drives you? You've achieved everything. You're a millionaire. You have five championships. People refer to you as the greatest, you know, athlete of all times. What do you still have to kind of achieve? That's it. I mean, why won't you just rest? And the guy said something interesting. He said, I mean, the reason I'm going to, you know, kick ass tomorrow night at the game in whatever, wherever, is that there is this child there that is like 9 years old and he bought a ticket to see me. And for that child, I'm going to give a performance of my life, irrespective of what I've achieved up until now. And when I think about it, it touches me a lot, because when I think about it, it's an inspiration. When I have new employees that join Pentera now, employee 350, 360, 370, they haven't been part of the legacy up until now. But I have to be their CEO as well. I have to lead by example. I have to, inspire these guys as well, so they can continue follow me and follow the Pentera narrative and what we're about. So I like that a lot. And that was, an inspiration to me and how I run the company.
So let's talk about now also blending in the Army experience, because you were for 4 years, and obviously in Israel is mandatory. But in your case, you were there for 4 years. And how would you say that shaped who you are today, especially when it comes to discipline as well?
Yes, absolutely. So I've been lucky to be at an elite unit, at the paratroopers unit here at the IDF, and I've been an officer. So I've been through a lot. And I think what I've taken from that time is, really goes down to hard work, perseverance, resilience. When you go through something like that, when you're so young, nothing can really break you. No investor dynamic or it's a bad quarter or a bad hire, or you want to hire someone, this guy went to another place, or any stress in work, anything, gets a different perspective when you go through like real Army experiences. People that have gone through that know what I'm talking about. People that haven't gone through that would never know. But I think that's something that, I don't regret. I'm happy I did that. Although in real time, how it is that you make something much more amazing in retrospect than when it's real time. But yes, it was hard. But I think the lessons learned are very important, especially when it comes to you to prove yourself all the time and you don't take anything for granted. And it's really about, when I was an officer, it's really about lessons around leadership. So I always had the ranks, but I never tried to lead people because I'm more senior. It was always because of the example I'm serving to them. So when I had to force someone to do something because I'm superior to this person, then in my leadership style, I failed. Still today at Pentera, I manage the management team here. These are very senior people. Some of them have been through more than me in life, and they've seen more than me. And I can't possibly get their support or their trust just because I'm the CEO. Then it needs to be more than that. So I always try to work the hardest and really lead by example, never thinking that just because I'm the CEO, then you have to do what I'm telling you or you have to follow my way. I need to convince you. I need to get your buy-in. And it's stuff I've learned in the Army.
So in your case, after the Army, you decided to travel a little bit. You went to New York. And obviously that shaped you quite a bit. New York shapes everyone, no? It shaped me too. So I'm sure that was quite life-changing for you. And then eventually after that, you go to Israel, you get into, complete, your studies there. And then you start, to work in different companies in the sales department. So I believe, I'm a big believer that, it doesn't matter if you have the best. If people don't know about it, it doesn't matter, especially when it comes to being a founder, to building a company like you've done now, that distribution is everything. So what would you say that you learned throughout the years, really on the sales side of things? And how was that transitioning to starting out Pentera?
Yeah. So it's a great question, because if I look at the landscape of CEOs like me in the cybersecurity space, and Israel is a great supplier to the world of cybersecurity companies, I would say that very few, maybe 2-3% of all CEOs in this space in Israel, maybe a bit more, maybe a bit less, have my background. Most of them come from the right Army units, the right technology units. So they kind of come with the cybersecurity background to their CEO positions. And their technologies, they try to transform to become business people as they raise money and become CEOs of companies. To be really, really honest, I struggle to understand how this is a natural move. I can understand how you can be a founder, technologist that comes up with a great idea and builds a product. But this has very weak correlation in my point of view to becoming a CEO of a company at our magnitude. Almost like almost no correlation between what you need, the skill set you need to build the first product and to get to the first 10 customers, and then to be a leader of a big company. These things are completely, you know, if you have both, then you're a very gifted individual. In most cases, you don't. So then comes the question, what's more important for, you know, a company to thrive? A strong technologist, the legacy guy leading it all the way, or someone that, you know, is more used to running businesses and running P&Ls? So to me, stepping into the CEO position, I think, was quite natural after having done two VP of sales positions, because I felt the stress and I felt board members and the responsibility to look after the company's number. And I was always used to have a strong CTO, just that they didn't report to me, that were looking after, you know, the production facility, like developing the product, researching and product management. These domains were never under me, nor was G&A under me. So the main difference for me is that I had to basically take everything I've learned as a sales leader in my past, which transcended quite well to the CEO life, but then learn a lot about the R&D domain, how these guys think, how they're driven, motivated. What does it mean to be running marketing and not be parallel to marketing as a VP of sales? What does it mean to run the G&A function, finance, legal? So I was very curious and learned a lot and asked a lot and came very humble to all those, you know, responsibilities that I didn't know anything about.
So then talk to us about then being at the right time, meeting your co-founder that had kind of like the idea, more the technical background, because it was like a matchmaking made in heaven, you know, and I think that you kind of like pinpointed that really nicely, because I mean, I see so many companies from Israel that have developed such amazing stuff in cybersecurity, but the ultimately the founders, they're like extremely technical. So I find that in this case, you know, you guys were so fortunate to meet one another. So how did that happen and what was that journey into bringing this to life?
Yeah. So I was introduced to Arik Liberzon back in 2017 by, you know, Arik's co-founder at the time, Arik Feingold, and by the very early investor at Pantera, Oz Ventures. Those guys Oz Ventures invested at Pantera when we were basically nobody. So give them all the credit for identifying what this could be. But it was just like, you know, a bunch of guys. And Arik was humble enough to say, I'm a CTO. I don't want to be a CEO. My passion is product development and being the visionary. And I said, that's amazing because I'm not a product guy. I do understand how this works and I can relate to product management concept, but I'm not, you know, a Mr. Know-all. I'm not this guy. And I could only succeed as a CEO if I have a technical in the technology space. In this space, I can only succeed as a founder, co-founder, CEO, if I have a co-founder, CTO, who is very technical and is very passionate about what he does, he or she, and humble enough to say, and I want to welcome someone from the outside to be the CEO of the company, of the idea I thought about. Not every founder is humble enough to admit that they can't be the CEO. And Arik was, you know, a responsible grown-up. I think it was indeed a match made in heaven. We didn't know each other a second before we had dinner. We've spoken about, you know, about what this could become. We were both 40-year-old with, you know, three kids when we've met. So we kind of both came quite mature to this adventure. And I think that although we're very different to a large extent, we're also very similar. We've realized it after this matched marriage happened. And I couldn't have thought of a better partner to the journey than Arik.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So
that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So talk to us now about how has the business model of Pantera evolved and how are you guys making money today?
As any venture, it starts with crazy people like me and Arik and others say, hey, this could become the biggest, you know, the next biggest thing out of Israel, out of, you know, the cyberspace. But, you know, everyone says that about their startup because everyone, you have to be this guy to get anywhere. So it started with a big, bold vision. We had to believe and we all had to bring our number twos and our trusted people from the past to kind of work with us. So Arik immediately kind of hired Ran Tamir, our chief product officer, and Alex Bivakovsky, a VP of research at Pantera. They served together in the army. I quite fast hired Aviv Cohen to be my CMO. We used to be peers. I was VP sales. He was VP marketing at a different company. And I hired Sivan Arel from Earnix, another company I worked for, to be the first salesperson on the ground to run big parts of Europe. Now she's VP of sales in EMEA. And we've hired like people we trust to go on this journey with us, and they brought more people. So we kind of had this cluster of like 30, 40 people that are, all of them are still with us, maybe minus one or two. And that is the core of Pantera, the core of the atom, if you want. So us 30 have been the people, the pioneers that have led, you know, have set examples for others and have led the company till now. Most of the people that joined then are now VPs and SVPs in the company. It's really about this camaraderie and this determination and conviction among all of us that we're building something amazing. Pantera is very famous in the VC world as a company that didn't miss a quarter for 26 quarters, which is quite crazy for a privately held company that's young, that's not, you know, traded on NASDAQ. And that goes back to how we forecast, you know, some sales marketing fundamental that we think we've cracked and stuff like that. We've taken the company through a few funding rounds. We've just crossed the 1,000 customers milestone a week ago. We're very, very proud of that. And the best is yet to come.
So talk to us about fundraising. How much capital have you guys raised to date and how has been that journey?
Yeah. So we've raised up until now into the company over $100 million. And there were more deals between shareholders that happened in parallel. The journey has been fascinating. And maybe one of my tips to entrepreneurs listening to me, people who are thinking to start a company or started a company and they're in this journey. When you raise money, people would tell you everything you need to hear so that they get into your data room and so that they would get into your world. They would give you all kind of flattering, you know, compliments, and they would do everything to kind of get to know you. And some of them would also give you offers. And some of those offers early on might be very tempting to take very fast. I would say one warning here is, be careful of the investors you bring in. I have to say that I'm very proud of all the investors that I've teamed up with. I know stories of other founders that kind of regretted that, you know, they took the money too fast from some people, because then you live with these guys. You live with them. It becomes a family. So the CEO at the beginning is really attached to the, you know, co-founders and like the internal management of the company and maybe to one investor. As the company progresses and goes on and goes higher, then the CEO and the board members, it's usually a few investors, become like a cluster of itself. So you have your, I would say, nuclear family at home, wife, kids, or husband and kids. And then you have the family of the, you know, VPs, C-level guys. But then you have the investor kind of unique family where people have different, you know, motives and agendas. So since that is inevitable, because people join at different stages of the company and you can't really control what people, how people would behave if the company goes well or if things don't go well, people can change. What usually doesn't change is the DNA of the human beings on your board, because you need to quite fast understand whether you talk to a very junior guy on the investor side that sits on your board. Maybe that junior guy, when things get a bit messy, wouldn't be the person to count on or to rely on. Whether the investors basically place partners and GPs on your board, which I think sends a strong signal about how much conviction they have in your company. So those things are things to pay attention to as you raise money. The identity of the personas sitting on your board, it's very important.
What about challenging the VC template-ish, you know, way of thinking, you know, of caging every company they deal with?
Yeah, it's very, very important. Great point and a very important item. I think that I was lucky to start the CEO journey after being VP of sales for many years. But people who haven't been in the business space at all, maybe just after the army and then they start a company, they might hear all kinds of VC recommendations and take them as if it came from God himself, herself, whatever you want to believe. And they're not doubting it because allegedly the VC sees 100 like you or thousands like you, and you're a one-off. So what do you know, right, that can challenge them? However, if you've gone through some stuff, then you can challenge them, especially if you have some words of wisdom or some stuff that has some substance behind it that can challenge the paradigm. For example, most VCs would invest in Israel in the cyberspace in specific teams from specific army units at specific age, and that has been the template. You know, many of those don't make it. They just fail, but you don't hear about it. You hear about the guy that did make it. So the fact that, you know, we were born in a way as a unique company with a unique C-level structure, I think is very interesting. That's one challenge. Second one, another tip you get from VCs early on is US is the world and the rest is the rest. And I challenge that. I still challenge it. I think it's not the case. The US is the biggest market that we have, and it probably represents the biggest kind of, you know, gift to any founder that want to go to the world. However, please don't be blind to amazing territories like the UK and Germany and Spain and France and Italy and others. Probably don't go against them, you know, at the same time at the beginning. But as you place your bets in the US, it's always important to have a bet or two in Europe as you grow from round A to round B, so that you're not highly, completely dependent just on the US buying dynamics and the US economy. Today, Pantera has presence in 18 countries. And we have 1,000 customers from 64 countries. So we're very much an international business. Although, yes, the U.S. is the most important region for, I would say, any cyber or fintech or, you know, B2B founder, any founder in the B2B space, the U.S. should still be the main area of focus.
So now that we're talking about fundraising, you know, and investors and people that, you know, you're ultimately enrolling, you know, with the future that you're living into. And that not only is investors, it's also employees, customers. I guess the question that comes to mind is, if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Pantera is fully realized, what does that world look like?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say that the ultimate vision that probably would materialize, I would assume 4 to 6 years from now, because it takes time for companies like this to become mainstream, looks like the following. Just like if you remember, when you buy a laptop now, any great laptop has this sticker that says Pentium inside or Intel inside. And that makes you as the buyer, even if you're just like a regular person, not like a big developer, that just like opens the internet and just maybe some Word documents, maybe some spreadsheets for the family economics, and maybe you download some stuff and maybe you have Netflix. Even if your usage of the laptop is very, very minimal, just the fact that you see the sticker says Pentium inside by Intel says, okay, wow, this computer I'm buying, I'm paying $100,000 for, has the sticker of, you know, credibility. Intel, Pentium, it's great. It's a great brand. So I kind of envision a world where we are approaching 3,000-4,000 customers, where each big household, big bank, healthcare, government institution, you know, industrialized company has Pentera inside, like a virtual sticker, saying, telling the hackers, hey, why won't you go try elsewhere? Because this company is powered by Pentera. This business is protected by Pentera. Pentera is trying us inside out, outside in, native cloud, on-prem. You know, they test the perimeter. Pentera attacks our business like the attackers, which is what we do using technology. So we feel quite good about how resilient we are against tomorrow's attack. So my dream, my vision is that I wake up in the morning and, you know, most of Fortune 500 companies would be in that position, that they will be protected by Pentera and will become as famous as the Intel Pentiums.
So you've been at it now for close to 7 years with Pentera. And you know, I guess the what comes to mind here is, you know, we're talking about the future, but I want to talk about the past, but doing so with a lens of reflection. So let's say I was to put you into a time machine and I'm able to bring you back to 2018, okay, when you guys were like starting to discuss, you know, a world where you could bring, you know, the solution that you guys are doing now, you know, to what you were encountering as a problem back then. And you're able to like step right there, you know, in the picture and being able to tap on the shoulder of that younger self. And let's say that that younger self listened and you're able to give that younger self one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Yeah. So obviously, you know, we've done lots of mistakes on the way. Thankfully, not big mistakes that kind of have taken Pentera off track. But I think one thing that I would say, Amitai, 7 years ago is what I think I did tell myself back then, but I just didn't come from the future. And I think it's a great thing to say, maybe if, even if it's not what people really want to hear. If you are looking for too much balance in your work-life balance, I mean, probably this is not your business. I know we're in 2024 and many people from Gen Z and even, you know, older say, hey, you know, work is not everything in this life, in this world. There are so many more things to kind of be, you know, exploring and you know, and doing. And I can't be that fanatic about my, this is just a job. So if you think like that, it's great. Please don't open a company or don't go in with high expectations because you need to put mega sacrifices. You need to put everything, you know, next to the venture for the venture to get to the peaks. You know, Pentera got to $1 billion valuation in 2021. For that to happen, so many people had to make Pentera their number one priority in life. I would say yes. I mean, I want to say that my wife and kids are, you know, amazing. They come first. There were many situations where, you know, they came second. And you need to have a very supportive home to do that. I can be as talented as whomever. But if your wife or your significant other or your girlfriend or whoever you have at home doesn't give you the backing you need if you have kids, then it's very, very hard because you need someone to be there for you when you go back home, when you go from a, you know, frustrating business trip or when you go through a frustrating investor dynamic, when something doesn't go well with your co-founder and you think the world is coming to an end. There needs to be someone there to, you know, so two things I'm saying. One is be all in without being frustrated that you're sacrificing so much because that is the life of entrepreneurs. And the second thing is have someone there that believes in you, irrespective of how quarter A or quarter B worked or how this hire went or that hire would happen. It's just about, you know, someone that believes in you and says, hey, I look at you from the sidelines. I'm seeing that the journey, someone that gives you a mirror because CEOs usually don't get compliments. I don't wake up in the morning, people coming to me and say, Amitai, you're an amazing CEO. We're so happy you are a leader. You know, can we make you a cup of coffee? Says nobody. Usually CEOs don't get that mirror from anyone. People that come to meet with me, they want something. If these are my direct reports, okay, we work together. But people that just want to talk to me usually need something from me. And I'm needed usually to solve the most complex things. It's never to just tell me how amazing I am. So it's usually helpful and recommended to have someone that believes in you, that kind of sticks with you for good and bad.
This is profound. Very profound and also very authentic, Amitai. I really appreciate you sharing that. I'm sure that there's a lot of people that are listening right now and super inspired with the conversation and are probably wondering what is the best way for them to reach out and say hi. What would you tell them?
Yeah, so I would say, first of all, to if anyone builds a company and they want to have a chat, I'm a friendly guy, at least I think. I just don't have too much time, as you might imagine. So anyone that wants anything, a piece of me, can definitely reach out via LinkedIn. I think my profile is there. People can reach out and just drop me like a message, say what they want to talk about, and I'll try to fit people into my calendar as time allows. I try to look at myself as a friendly guy in many conferences where I give talks, or when I get off stage of some places, Black Hat or RSA or whatever, people kind of catch me when I'm going down to say, hey, can I talk to you? Can I call you? And I try to be friendly because I know it's hard. It's not easy. And founders usually don't have friends that are founders as well. And so if you're a founder and you start climbing this career, this ladder, usually you're quite alone. It's very rare that a founder has really good friends that are also founders of companies, and you can kind of talk to your best buddy from high school and you're both founders of cybersecurity companies. Usually doesn't happen. Happy to help. And
amazing. Well, Amitai, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, and good luck to everyone listening to us. The world is big for many people to succeed.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.